welcome to the Moth Radio Hour. The Moth has been producing live storytelling evenings since 1997. Our shows feature true stories from all kinds of people. They stand up one at a time, under a spotlight, behind a microphone, in front of a live audience. They have no script or notes. This hour, we have four stories, three from our main stage series and one from our open mic story slam. Our first story is from Matt McGough. It's about his first day as a bat boy for the New York Yankees. Matt told the story at a Moth show we called Wheelin' and Dealin', stories about the business of doing business. Here's Matt live at the Moth.
I grew up a huge fan of the New York Yankees, which when I was very small involved going to games maybe once a year with my father and my little brother, watching Reggie Jackson, then a little bit older watching Dave Winfield. And then when I kind of came into my teens, Don Mattingly, who was, you know, my absolute favorite player. And as I, you know, I went to high school in New York, and it was kind of a turning point, the first time that I went to a Yankee game by myself, and I started going to Yankee games by myself. And it was at one of these games in the fall of 1991 that I went up to the stadium, bought a ticket to the bleachers, and went and sat in the bleachers and was watching the game, and noticed for the first time something that I'd been to the stadium so many times before, but I'd never seen this kid in right field wearing a Yankee uniform, who was a bat boy, playing catch with the right fielder. And I'd never noticed the bat boy before, and this kid could not play catch for his life. He was throwing the ball over Jesse Barfield's head, the right fielder, and he was one hopping him. And I was like, you know, I'm not a great athlete, but I can play catch at least as well as this kid can, and I don't understand why he has, you know, that job and I couldn't. And so I went home that night and I tore a page out of the program that listed all the different, you know, Yankee executives, and I wrote a handwritten letter to everyone from Steinbrenner on down to Stump Merrill, who was the manager at that point, and basically said, you know, my name is Matt and I'm 16 years old and I'm a huge fan of the Yankees, and, you know, I don't know if you can apply for this bat boy position, but if you can, I really would like an application, and I'm so excited to hear from you that if I don't hear from you soon, I'm going to follow up with a phone call. So sent these off, and about 2 weeks went by, and after, you know, 2 weeks, I hadn't heard anything, and so I picked up the phone, and the Yankee switchboard number was on the same list of executives, and secretary answered the phone, hello, New York Yankees, and I said, hi, this is Matt McGough, and I sent a letter in a couple weeks ago about applying for a bat boy position, and nobody got back to me. So she's like, okay, well, take your name down, and I'll have somebody get back to you, and she took my number down, and another week goes by, and I don't hear anything, so I pick up the phone again and I call, and this woman answers the phone, hello, New York Yankees. And I say, hi, this is Matt. You know, I sent some letters in about the bat boy position, and I called last week and somebody was supposed to call me back, but, you know, I thought it was kind of rude that they hadn't. And so she, you know, she laughed and she asked me, how old are you? And I said, 16. And she laughed some more, and I didn't really understand what she was laughing at, but, you know, she took down my name again. She said, you know, I'll make sure that somebody gets back to you. So, you know, a few days later, sure enough, in the mail, a letter arrived on Yankee letterhead, official letterhead, and it invited me to come up to the stadium for an interview with Nick Priori, who's the clubhouse manager. So I put my jacket and tie on, and I don't even think I told any of my friends about this because it was way too weird to explain. So I went up, took the 4 train up to the stadium and walked into the, you know, walked around the stadium, and this is October, so they weren't playing in the World Series in October back in 91, so it was very, very quiet, and I walked around the stadium and walked into the Yankee lobby, and there was a security guard there, and I introduced myself, and I say, I'm here for the bat boy interview, and he picks up the telephone, and he's like, you know, Nick, some kid's here to see you, and you know, oh, okay, so he says, you know, have a seat. So I sit down in the pinstripe lobby, and I'm, you know, passing about 10 minutes waiting for this guy, Nick, to come up for the first job interview of my life, or the first job of my life. And I'm, you know, trying to think of the questions that he might ask me. So I'm ready to tell him what my favorite subject is in school and tell him, you know, why I think the Yankees need a big bat behind Mattingly, you know, to win the pennant next year, and what, you know, Mickey Mantle's batting average was in 1956, and like all these different questions. So, you know, I'm kind of passing the time, and these double doors burst open, and this guy walks in, obviously Nick, but he doesn't introduce himself. He's, you know, could be anywhere from 40 to 80 years of age. He has this greased back hair, and he has a stogie between the two teeth left in his mouth, and a chaw of tobacco possibly also, and this wife beater t-shirt and Yankee shorts and white athletic socks pulled up to his knees, and he's shoe polished, like black sneakers that are obviously shoe polished, and he just looks at me and says, are your parents going to mind you taking the train home late at night? So I say, you know, I take the train to school every day. I think it'll be fine. And he just kind of looks at me, and finally I say, no, I don't think my parents will mind me taking the train home late at night. And he says, we'll come back opening day. So that was October. You know, I go home. I think I have the job. I'm not really sure. And, you know, 6 months later, opening day, 1993, I show up at 9 a.m. I put on my jacket and tie. I walk back to the stadium. I go back downstairs, you know, through these tunnels and come to this, you know, big steel door that says Yankee Clubhouse on, and I walk inside, and it's complete pandemonium. And, you know, there's these ball players that I'd only seen before on TV or across rows and rows of stadium seats, and like they're there in the flesh in front of me, and Don Mattingly is over, you know, on the right, and I had a poster of Don Mattingly above my bed, you know, for my whole life, and he's standing right over there, and Jimmy Key, the ace of the pitching staff, is over there, and all these guys. And, you know, opening day at Yankee Stadium is not just a sports event, it's a news event. It's the beginning of spring in New York, and Mayor Dinkins is there with his entourage, and just Mayor Dinkins and Don Mattingly, you know. It's so I'm walking around and just kind of lost, and I figure, you know, I better go find Nick. So I walk up to Nick and I say, Nick, I'm Matt, we met a couple months ago, what do you want me to do? It's my first day of work. So he says, stay that F out of my way. So I kind of like shrink back and throw my backpack over on the side, and I'm just kind of wandering around in a daze, and I feel a tap on my shoulder. And I turn around, and it's Don Mattingly. And he sticks his hand out and he says, how's it going? I'm Don Mattingly. Are you going to be working with us this year? Which, you know, even at that moment, I'd never really thought about the experience in those terms. And he could have said so many other things that wouldn't have been as cool as that. Like, he could have said, you know, who are you? Or are you the new Bat Boy? Or are you going to be working for us this year? But he said, you know, I'm Don Mattingly. Are you going to be working with us this year? So I said, I know who you are, Mr. Mattingly. I'm Matt. I'm the new Bat Boy. And he's like, great to meet you, Matt. I have a very big, very big job to ask of you. I've just unpacked all my bats from spring training, and I don't know if it was the altitude of the flight up from Florida or the humidity down there or what, but the game starts in about 2 hours, and I need you to find me a bat stretcher. So I say, okay. So I go and find Nick, and I go, you know, Nick is busy. Probably half a dozen ball players are like bothering him for AA batteries, or, you know, my hat's too small, or this or that. And I go up and I'm like, Nick, I need a bat stretcher for Don Mattingly. And he lets loose with a stream of expletives that fell on, I swear, completely virgin ears. Like, I'd never heard that type of language in the movies before or anywhere, let alone directed at me. So I kind of like rock back on my heels and go and find somebody I can trust, like Nick's assistant Rob, and I ask him, you know, I need a bat stretcher for Don Mattingly. And Nick told me to go F myself, and I don't know what to do. So he was like, chill out. You know, I saw Danny Tartable using one in his locker. So Danny Tartable's the, you know, power hitting right fielder. I go to his locker, and he's getting dressed in his uniform, and I stand off on the side, and he says, you know, how's it going? And I'm like, fine, I'm Matt, I'm the new bat boy, and I need a bat stretcher for Don Mattingly, and I heard you were just using one. So he's like, well, I was using one, but I left it in the manager's office. You should probably go check in there. So I say, thanks, and he says, see you around. And I go into the manager's office and walk in, and Buck Showalter, the manager, is having a press conference with probably like 8 or 10 reporters. And I stand off on the side, and I'm kind of, you know, the conversation comes to a standstill basically because there's the 16-year-old kid there in his Easter blazer and jacket and standing in the manager's office at Yankee Stadium 2 hours before first pitch on opening day, looking very lost and very anxious. And Showalter turns to me and he's like, can I help you? And I say, I'm Matt, I'm the new BAP. I'm really sorry to interrupt, but I need a bat stretcher for Don Mattingly, and Danny Tartable says that he left it in here. So Showalter looks down like beneath his desk, and, you know, he's like, well, you know, do you need a right-handed one or a left-handed one? So this is the first moment all day that I actually, you know, this is the first question that I had that I could answer with complete confidence, because you couldn't have grown up in New York at that time, you know, without knowing that Mattingly was the best left-handed hitter in baseball. So I say, do I need a left-handed bat stretcher? So he's like, well, I think we maybe have a right-handed one around here, but probably not a left-handed one. I'm like, you should try it out at the Red Sox clubhouse and see if they have one. So I said, okay, thanks. You know, I'm sorry to interrupt. I go out. At this point, I'm like sprinting down the hallways, like the tunnels beneath the stands, the first base stands at the stadium, and I run into the Red Sox clubhouse and find their equipment manager and give him like the whole story. I'm at him. The new bat boy for the Yankees, and Danny Tartable left his right-handed bat stretcher in Buck Showalter's office, and he had a left-handed one, and like the game's about to start, and he's like, calm down. Like, you know, we don't have one, but we need one. Like, here's $20. Go up to the sporting goods store on 161st Street and River Avenue and buy two. Like, buy a left-handed one for Mattingly and a right-handed one for us, and then bring me back the change. So he gives me the 20, I put it in my pocket, I run upstairs. You know, at this point, it's like an hour before opening day. The fans are coming down, like 50,000 fans are coming down from, you know, the subway in the opposite direction that I'm walking. I'm the only person in the world who knows that, you know, if I don't come through on this mission, Mattingly is going to go up there against Roger Clemens and the Red Sox on opening day at Yankee Stadium with a toothpick in his hand, basically. So I'm like fighting against the crowd and feeling so much weight on my shoulders, and I make my way, you know, and I'm about to cross the threshold of Stan Sporting Goods when it dawns on me, like, I've played a lot of baseball in my life, and I've, you know, been a big fan for a while, and like, I don't even know what a bat stretcher looks like. And it, this moment that I'm like walking into the store, it dawns on me for the first time, like, is this a joke? Like, could this possibly be a joke? And if it, you know, but I had so much fear because, like, if it is a joke and I go back and I tell Don Mattingly, you know, I'm too smart to fall for your, you know, your BS bat stretcher story, and I'm wrong, I'm going to be back in the bleachers, like, before my first game, you know, and lose my dream job. So, you know, I take three laps around the stadium, kind of convincing myself, like, it's got to be a joke. Like, it's got to be a joke. And I, you know, I walk back in, I go down the stairs, I walk into the clubhouse, Mattingly winks at me from across the clubhouse, a couple of other ball players laugh. Mattingly goes 3-for-5 that day, Yankees win, it was my first day in pinstripes, and you know, I didn't learn until later on that I was the first kid in anyone's memory to have gotten the job without having a connection, without, you know, somebody knowing somebody or my dad knowing somebody or whatever, which was, you know, a lesson in itself. And, you know, as intensely naive my pursuit of that job was, you know, I was probably as naively intense in chasing the bat stretcher. But, you know, the lesson in the story is, you know, when there's, with a great deal of persistence and a little bit of common sense, even if the thing you're chasing may not exist, you can sometimes will it into being. Thank you.
That was Matt McGaugh. Matt was working as a law clerk when he first walked into one of our open mic nights, and we immediately decided to snatch him up for our main stage series. He later went on to write the memoir Bat Boy, Coming of Age with the New York Yankees, and he's now a writer on NBC's Law and Order. This is the Moth Radio Hour. When we come back, we're going to hear a story about flying eyeballs and old ladies spying on the Kennedys. Stay tuned.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
I'm Leah Tao, your host this week for the Moth Radio Hour. True stories, no notes, live audience. Up next is Michaela Murphy. Her story was recorded at a moth show we called Starstruck, stories about the razzle dazzle. Here's Michaela live at the moth.
Thank you. Hi. I grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, and for my entire childhood, we were never more than 20 miles away from the core of our universe, the Kennedys. We were Irish, they were Irish. We were Catholic, they were Catholic. They were family. We were like the relatives that they never got to see. But we knew, you know, they're busy, and we knew that they loved us. So anything that was happening to them was also happening to us. So their tragedy plus our own tragedy was a lot. So this one Thanksgiving after dinner and a family fight at Grandma's house, we were in the car and we're driving home, and the radio was playing this 10th anniversary of the JFK assassination. And I'm sitting in the back seat, and I start to cry. And my sister Erin says, "Hey, Dad, Michaela's crying." And my father pulls that car right over to the shoulder of I-95. He stops it, he turns around, and he looks at us. And with tears in his own eyes, he says, "Don't you ever be ashamed to cry for that man." So my parents grew up near Newport, and they got married in the same exact church as Jack and Jackie, St. Mary's. And my father gave exact replica jewelry to my mother that was replications of the jewelry that Jack gave to Jackie. And every Saturday night after Mass, my family would be in the living room, and we'd be happily ever aftering to the original soundtrack of Camelot. And every year during the 70s, my four aunts would take me and my two cousins on their dream vacation, a rented beach house in Hyannis on the very cove sharing beachfront with the Kennedy compound. Every day for an entire week, my Aunt Pat would roll up her sister's hair. My aunts would apply sunscreen to the back of their necks, the backs of their hands, and the tops of their feet. And then they would drag their beach chairs down to the beach, and they would set them up perfectly, not facing the water, not into the sun for tanning, but perfectly for spying on the Kennedys. They would sit there all day in the broiling sun with high-powered binoculars and keep a constant surveillance. And every year they'd have the same exact conversations. Usually around mid-morning, the first sighting would be made, usually by my Aunt Pat. She'd be, "Up. They got Rose out. Walking. Ethel looks drawn." And then about an hour later, my Aunt Gert would say, "How old is Rose now?" And Aunt Momo would make the calculations. "Well, let's see. Jack died in 63 when she was 74. And Rose's birthday was 2 weeks last Thursday. And Joe died in 69, making her a widow at 81. So 85. And then they'd break for lunch. So after lobster and drawn butter and hosing us down, they'd all hustle back to their posts, and they'd watch. And every now and then, there'd be something they didn't know. "Hey, who's that? Who's that? Who's that?" So they'd draw out the family tree in the sand. They'd analyze it. They'd come up with a profile, and they'd crack the code. "It's one of Bobby's." Now, any mention of Bobby would always bring up the inevitable, "Oh, I just pray to God they don't tell poor senile Rose about Bobby. It'll break her." So then the long afternoon stretch would end with the inevitable annual observation, "You don't see Jackie much here." And then all of my aunts would drop their binoculars and look at each other meaningfully. Now, all of this meant that no one was paying any attention to me and my cousins in the water. And the summer when we were 9 years old, we found something. Now, had an aunt, perhaps in an effort to ease a cramp in her prying neck, just sort of glanced towards the water, she might have seen us climbing into this tiny, plastic, half-inflated boat. She might have cried out in alarm at the lack of oars and life vests. She might have had a conniption fit to see us shove off and drift into the violent riptide that would sweep us within 5 minutes out to the open sea and the Nantucket-bound ferry. But an aunt didn't, and we did. It all happened so fast that we were swept out, and it wasn't until we realized that we could make out the specific features of the ferry passengers that we were really far from shore. We were so far from shore that my aunts were now reduced to four hopping dots. Uh-oh, it was like Gilligan's Island for real. So an Atlantic swell crashes over our heads, and as soon as the water clears out of our eyes, a powerboat pulls up out of nowhere. And in this powerboat are David and Michael Kennedy. So David and Michael pull us up into the boat, and we are like, oh my God, we are saved by a powerboat. So the powerboat sends us back to shore, and we're psyched because we're saved until we start to watch the four hopping dots morph back into our four crazed, livid aunts. We are so gonna get it. Now, my family, under any circumstances, has this really weird thing. Well, they each have like their own weird thing about like yelling and getting into huge trouble. Like my Aunt Gert, like she gets so freaked out that all she can do is yell out our addresses. Like, Eileen and Kevin, 275 Hooper Street. Michaela, 180 Asylum Road. I swear to God, I grew up on Asylum Road. that's a very telling piece of my childhood. And then my Aunt Pat would do these things where she would say these things that were like actually kind of nice things, but she'd say them like they were death threats. She'd be like, yeah, I'll save you from drowning. You get on that beach towel and you lie in that sun now. Or she'd say, I'm going to buy you a birthday present. You eat that cake now. So we knew that this is what was coming. The Kennedy boys didn't. So they're vivaciously tanned and they pull up to the shoreline and we brace ourselves. Now, what happens is our aunts are out of their minds. They're ready to flay us. But when they see us in the same boat as the Kennedys, it's like they don't have the emotional capacity to handle it. They kind of snap. They're kind of like freaking out to yell at us, but they start fake smiling and trying to act all normal. And my Aunt Momo, she's like, takes on this like Kennedy-esque way of speaking, which is sort of halfway between Katharine Hepburn and like the Queen of England. And we're like looking at them like, what are you guys doing? And they're smiling the smile, but when they smile at us, it's like, you just wait. But they're like, oh, David, oh, Michael, thank you, thank you, thank you. And they're not mad at us for almost drowning. They're mad at us because the Kennedys had to save us. Like, don't those people have enough trouble? Now you? Like, as if our almost drowning was yet another Kennedy tragedy. So these poor boys finally pull and pry themselves away from my aunts. They get back on the boat, and they're leaving, and my Aunt Momo's going, please give our best to your grandmother. And now it's time for our for real punishment, which was that we, for the rest of vacation, had to stay on the beach because we did not have any respect for the water. So it's 100 degrees out. And after about a half hour of whining and fighting and like emptying out all the copper tone and kicking sand, we break my Aunt Pat's last nerve and she says, all right, you can go in the water, but only up to your knees. So we're happy for a minute until we get in the water and realize how boring up to your knees is. And then we get the great plan of having chicken fights. So we start to have chicken fights, but it's kind of weird because there's only three of us. So, but we're doing the best we can to have a chicken fight like that and like knock each other off into the water so we get fully immersed. And then my Uncle Al, who never, ever played with us, ever, comes into the water to play chicken fights with us. And he puts his daughter, my cousin Eileen, up on his shoulders. And then I get up on my cousin Kevin's shoulders and we're having chicken fights. And it's like actual family fun for a moment. And we're like, you know, hitting each other, falling in the water. And then I take my foot and I accidentally kick the side of my Uncle Al's head really, really hard. And his eyeball pops out of his head, falls into the water, and sinks. It pops out of his head, and it sinks. Eileen, Kevin, and I are in instant, complete shock. Right this minute, there is still a part of me that is on that beach screaming. It's like, oh my God. We had no idea that he had a fake eye. We didn't even know that you could have a fake eye. Why would you have a fake eye? They didn't tell us that Uncle Al had a fake eye because they didn't want us blabbing it to the whole neighborhood. So they didn't tell us, so we didn't know. And like later on, you know, there was Columbo and Sandy Duncan, but this was way before that. We had no idea. So we're all standing there and it's like so horrible. Like I can't even like, I'm like, oh my God. And my cousins Eileen and Kevin are staring at me with complete hate, like you broke our dad. And my Uncle Al is standing there and he's got the lid open. So you can like see inside the socket where now it's just like skin and the eyeball gone. And like, you cannot just say, I'm sorry to someone that you just, so I don't know what to do. And my Aunt Pat is hysterically screaming because that eyeball cost top dollar. It was a special magnetized eye so it could keep up with the other one. And now I had just better pray that vacation was over and that they got that deposit back, because now they were going to have to buy a brand new top dollar eye that was not in the budget. So I just didn't know what to do. I was like, my life is over. I am no longer Michaela. I am now Murph's girl who kicked Al's eye out in the Cape. And it's awful, and everybody's just crying and pointing at me, and now my other aunts are getting in on it, like, and who's the blame part of the conversation's happening. So I just kind of back off into the water. I'm kind of like going back and like regressing back to like where life as I once knew it had ended. And I just stand there and like, I kind of wish I had drowned. And I kind of wish the Kennedys hadn't saved me. And I bent off into the waves and I just start like sifting through sand and shells and pebbles, and it's totally ridiculous, but like I will never stop looking for this eye. I'm gonna look forever. And I keep looking and looking and I'm sifting through, and then all of a sudden there is an eyeball in my palm staring right at me. And so I scream and I drop it back and it sinks back into the water. But now we know it's possible. So everybody gets back into the water and now we're all sifting through and sifting through, and I pray to God for no more future happiness until we find this eye. And I also kind of pray that it not be me the one that finds it this time. So after like an hour, my cousin Kevin finds the eye and he holds it up in triumph and he does not let go. And my Uncle Al takes the eye, he like washes it off and just pops it back in. And then he kind of like tests it, you know, and it's like keeping up with the other one, so it's working still. And now it's the weirdest thing, because now we know it's a fake eye. And now that you know it's a fake eye, it totally looks like a fake eye. And I can't believe that I never noticed it wasn't a fake eye before. So now vacation's back on. And so everybody gets back into their beach chairs and they start to settle down to begin telling the story over and over, like a million times, about what I just did. And I have not really fully reintegrated back into the family yet. I'm kind of standing apart. And I notice that there actually has been like kind of a group of people who've been watching this whole thing. And then I see something that I didn't notice, that no one noticed. And that's that two of the Kennedy kids, David and Michael, had taken a walk on the beach. And I can tell just by the look on their faces that they had stood there and seen the entire episode. That they had been there watching us. Thank you.
That was Michaela Murphy. She lives in Seattle and she's working on a memoir called The Green Monster. You're listening to the Moth Radio Hour, and we'll be back in a minute with another story. If you have a story, call our story hotline at 877-799-MOTH. That's 877-799-6684. Or you can record your pitch right on our website, themoth.org, where you can also learn about our free weekly podcast. I'm Leah Tao, and you're listening to the Moth Radio Hour. Next up is Anthony Griffith. Anthony is a comedian, but we should warn you that the story he's about to tell is not funny. In fact, I think it's one of the saddest stories we've ever presented at the Moth, and you might find it too intense for your kids to hear. But Anthony was very clear that the time had come for him to tell this story. Here's Anthony live at the Moth.
Charles Dickens' classic tale, Tale of Two Cities, starts off with the phrase, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times. In 1990, I moved from Chicago with my family to LA to seek my fame and fortune, and And a couple of weeks of being there, I got two important phone calls. One was from the talent coordinator for The Tonight Show, offering me to have a spot as a comedian on The Tonight Show. And the second call was that my daughter's doctor had called up to say that her cancer had resurfaced. A year prior, she was diagnosed with cancer, and we fought it, and it went into remission, and now it's back. And for that next year, my life was pretty surreal because it's like two different personalities. During the day, in order to keep my daughter at home with me, I would have to learn CPR and how to work a heart monitor and administer medicine, all these technical terms, and take her back and forth, to get her platelets and blood and check up on her. And at night, I would go from club to club with the talent coordinator, and I would work on my set and try to perfect it. And I would meet veterans like George Wallace and Seinfeld and Roseanne. And I thought that everything was great because we had beat the cancer before we could beat it again. And this was the first time that I was going to be in front of millions of people on The Tonight Show. And the first time on The Tonight Show, I was extremely nervous. All I could think about while I was backstage being introduced was, don't mess up. Just don't mess up. Whatever you do, don't mess up. And the curtains open, and there's 600 people, and the cameras, and Johnny's over there, and the band is over there. And I don't know what I said for the next 6 minutes, but I got six applause breaks. And the great part of that night was that I was going to my car, and I met Johnny, who was going to his car. And it was just a private moment between us in the parking lot of him saying, you were very funny. You're extremely funny. Start working on your second Tonight Show, because I want you back. By the time I got the official call for my second Tonight Show, my daughter was admitted to the hospital. If you don't know about cancer, when it comes back, it comes back hard. It's like beating up a gangbanger for the first time, and then it's coming back, and he's coming back meaner and stronger, and he's coming with his friends. So in order to compensate for that, you have to raise the chemo, and you have to raise the medicine, and you have to raise the radiation, which is difficult for an adult, but she was only two. So she's bald, which she doesn't mind because every kid in the ward is bald. And she thinks this is a part of life. And she can't keep her food down. And you're not prepared for this. There's no books. There's no home ed class to teach you how to deal with this. And you can't go to a therapist because in the black world, a therapist is taboo, as reserved for rich white people. So you're trying to figure it out. What did I do? Maybe it's something I did. Maybe it's something my wife did. Maybe my doctor diagnosed it erroneously, something. But at night, I still have to be a comic. I have to work on The Tonight Show because that's what I'm going to do. I'm a clown. I'm a clown whose medical bills are raising, who's one step from being evicted, who's one step from getting his car repoed, and I have to come out and make you laugh because no one wants to hear the clown in pain because that's not funny. And my humor is becoming dark, and it's biting, and it's becoming hateful. And the talent coordinator is seeing that there's a problem because the NBC is all about nice, and just everything is going to be okay. And we're starting to buck horns because he wants everything light, and I want to be honest and tell life. And I'm hurting, and I want everybody else to hurt. Because somebody is to blame for this. So I buck up,
and I suppress my anger, and I form and develop a nice, cute routine for the second Tonight Show, and I get applause breaks, and I get asked to come back for a third time. And I'm perfecting my third set, and the doctor asked me to come in, and I know something's wrong because even the doctor is crying, and doctors don't cry. And he said that we've done all we can. There's nothing else for us to do. And I said, how much time does she have? And he said, at the most, 6 weeks. And I should plan for that. And I'm thinking, how do I plan for that? I haven't planned to buy her first bicycle. I haven't planned to walk her to school. I haven't planned to take pictures of her on her prom. I haven't planned to walk her down the aisle to get married. How am I going to plan to buy her a dress to be buried in? And I'm trying to keep it together because I'm the man, and I'm the man of the house, and I don't want to cry, but it's coming, and I'm trying to tell myself, Tony, I'm trying to beg the world, just give me a chance, just give me a chance, just let me take a breath, just stop just for a minute. I want to call my parents and tell them, what do I do? I don't know what to do. I'm a grown man, and I don't know what to do. And a voice in me comes up like Denzel from Training Day, man up, nigga! You think you're the only one losing kids today? 25 kids walked in here with cancer, only 5 walking out. This ain't no sitcom. It don't wrap up all nice and tidy in 30 minutes. This is life. Welcome to the real world. And he was right. So I bucked up because that's what I'm supposed to do. And on my third Tonight Show, by that time my daughter had died. And I had 6 applause breaks that night. No one knew I was mourning. No one knew that I could care less about the Tonight Show or Johnny Carson. In 1990, I had 3 appearances with the legendary Johnny Carson and a total of 14 applause breaks. And I would have given it all if I could just have one more day sharing a bag of French fries with my daughter. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Thank you.
That was Anthony Griffin. We first met Anthony when we were going to a comedy festival, and we wanted the comedians to challenge themselves and consider telling serious stories. And that's when Anthony suggested telling this story. When he first told us the story over the phone, we were crying and he was crying, and we thought, is this too much? Are you sure you want to do this? And he said, listen, it's been 13 years since my daughter died, and it's time. I have to tell this story, and I have to tell it at this festival where there will be all these people from the comedy industry. They need to hear what it's like to be a clown with a broken heart. We said, Anthony, you have to be able to tell this story without crying. You won't be ready until you can do that. And it took months, but he got there. And then, of course, when he got in front of a real live audience, all the emotions welled up. I was worried he wouldn't get through it, but then from the depths of Anthony and years of grief came the anger in the Denzel Washington moment. We'd never seen this in Anthony before. That's the nature of live storytelling. You never know what's going to happen in the moment. When we return, we have one more story.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
Welcome back to the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Leah Tao. The stories you've heard so far have been from our main stage series. Next up, we're going to hear a story from the Moth's open mic night, the Moth Story Slam.
I'm always surprised that so many people show up because we're not famous or anything. And there's always like a line at the door to come see us, and it's $7, which is a lot of money these days. And so I'm always pleasantly surprised that it's a sold-out show. My only guess is that they come because a lot of people want to tell stories, so they come. And also, it's just beautiful in its simplicity, you know? There's no special effects or fancy lights. It's just someone telling a story, and usually most of the people in the audience can relate to it in some level.
At the Story Slams, anyone can come tell a 5-minute story. 10 people are picked at random, and it's a competition. This one is from Ed Gavigan from A Night with the Theme, Scars.
Remember the first scar I ever got was actually two scars. And I was about 6 years old teaching my little buddy next door how to golf. And I'd taken my dad's bag of golf clubs and dragged it out in the yard and just wanted to show my little buddy how to hit the ball. So I stood behind him and I had him choke up on the 9-iron and was telling him, you know, put the tee in the ball, and I was just all gung-ho to be a little teacher. And I stood back, and I had coached him on the backswing and the follow-through, and he wailed back and hit me in the head and came around and hit me in the head again. And the 9-iron took a chunk out of the back right quarter of my scalp and peeled about a palm-sized flap of skin and hair. And on the backswing, hit me on this side, and two giant flaps of skin peeled off my skull. And I wasn't sure what happened, but he turned around and he looked at me, and the blood, you know how a head wound is, the blood just starts pouring down. And I put my hands up, and I feel the soft, wet part, and then the little bristly, hairy part. Because I had a crew cut at the time, so I pushed my scalp back off. And I went running into my house, and I'll never forget the look on my mother's face. She's in the kitchen with her cat's eye glasses talking on the phone. And it was one of those black rotary dial phones, and she let go of the phone. I had blood running down my arms and all over my little white T-shirt. And she just made this dying pigeon noise. And then the first thing she did, because I had my younger brother and my younger sister, she called the neighbor to come and watch them. And then she called my dad and told him to meet us at the emergency room. And she threw me in the convertible and off we flew. And she was just locked on, driving like a mother to save her kid. And we pull up to the emergency room and that was at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas, 1969. My dad was a drill sergeant, so his job all day long was to yell at guys, tell them that they were no good and were going to die in Vietnam, and that his grandmother could do everything they could do but better. And My dad was a badass. I mean, my dad has like the tan. If you ever seen Full Metal Jacket, my dad would kick his ass. And, you know, rolled up sleeves, the tan uniform, the Smokey the Bear hat. And what I never realized at the time, or until much later, is that at that time, my dad was 26 years old and my mom was 25. So they bundle me in to the emergency room, or actually my dad hadn't gotten there yet. And so the doctor lays me up on the table and does a little pump, and I come up and he's looking at me and he's like, "Are you okay?" I'm like, "Yeah, you know, I'm okay." And then in comes my dad, and he's got the Smokey the Bear hat. He's like, "Where's my son?" There I am, drenched in blood on the table. And the doctor's like, "Well, we're just, you know, got to shave a little bit there, and then we got to stitch him up." And my dad's there, and he's holding my foot, and he's looking at me, and he's like, "Are you okay?" And, but I heard, "Are you okay?" So I was like, "Yes, sir, I'm okay, no problem." And the doctor then looks at my dad, and he goes, "I got to, you know, this is, you got to realize, if you've never been to an Air Force hospital, that it's not exactly like, you know, they do it on TV. It's kind of ad hoc. So he forgot something, or there, you know, he needed some extra parts or whatever. So he tells my dad, "Just stay here. I got to go get the needle or something." So I'm there and I'm looking at my dad and I'm got to impress him that that I'm okay. And he's looking at me and he's like, "Sure you're okay?" I'm like, "Yeah, Dad. Don't worry." And he's there with his, you know, Smokey the Bear hat. So this is like, I can't even describe to you what the drill sergeant aspect is unless you've lived it. And he looks at me and he's holding my foot and his eyes roll back in his head and he drops. And I think that he's trying to make me laugh. So I'm thinking, Dad's just trying to give me a little encouragement. And I'm there like laughing. On the way down, my father hit his head on the end of that metal table so bad it caught his eye socket and ripped himself a scar. I'm laying there going, "Dad, that's funny. Where are you?" And then the surgeon comes in and is like, "What the f-?" He's like, "Get up!" And he picks me up, and I help my dad, who is completely unconscious in a giant pool of blood with his tan uniform completely drenched. We help my father. He lowers the table. We get my dad onto the thing. He's stitching my dad up, and I'm watching and helping everything, and I'm just like bundled up. It's a guy just like wrapped me real quick. And my dad is out, like out cold, all right? And the surgeon's like, dude, gives him like 16 stitches from the corner of his eye all the way back up. And I'm like, "Oh, wow, like, I'm into it. I want my dad to be better." And then the surgeon's like, "All right." And he goes and gets a wheelchair. And he's like, "Help me put your dad in the chair." And we load my dad in the chair. And then he stitches me up. But because he knew mine were just superficial scalp wounds. It was. So then we get, I'm, you know, I'm all stitched up. And then he wraps my whole head up. And I got the big, you know, Q-tip looking head with the blood spots soaking through. And then they put my dad in the wheelchair. And my dad is still out. And the surgeon goes, "Just push him out to your mom, okay?" And my mother is in the waiting room. And I come out pushing my father in the wheelchair. But I'm only about this tall, so I'm kind of looking over the side. And I'll never forget the look on my mother's face. Just thank God she was sitting down when she fainted.
That was Ed Gavigan telling his winning story at a Moth Story Slam. Ed designs and builds furniture, and he recently became a dad. Moth Story Slams are held in New York and Los Angeles and will soon be coming to a city near you. If there's no Moth Slam in your city yet, go to our website to learn more about how you can start your own Moth Evenings. At themoth.org, you can also find information about how to pitch a Moth story. The best pitches will be featured online and voted on by the public. The winner will be flown to New York to tell his or her story live on stage.
That's themoth.org, and we are all ears.
Your host for the Moth Radio Hour this week was Leah Tao. Leah is also the executive and creative director of The Moth.
What we're going to do is each person's going to read the first line of their story. Tori, these are the folks that had their names in the hat and didn't get picked tonight.
The artistic director is Catherine Burns.
Being open-minded in a Buenos Aires massage parlor was the worst mistake I made in 2007.
Senior producers are Sarah Austin Jeunesse and Jennifer Hickson. The associate producer is Kate Tellers, and the program manager is Marianne Gadeberg.
I grew up in my mother's beauty shop in Texas. This fat little girl sitting on the front porch in a glittered up Burger King crown, dreaming of travel and adventure.
The Moth's radio intern is Natasha Haverty, and our recording engineer is Paul Ruest at the Argo Network in New York City. Our theme music is by The Drift.
The crystal vase was my stepmom's most prized possession.
The Moth is produced for radio by me, Jay Allison, at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, with help from Vicki Merrick. This hour was produced for the Open Studio Project, with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The show is presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. All the stories you heard were told with no scripts and no second takes. Moth stories are true, as remembered by the storyteller.
My first line really contains everything that I needed to assert. I was going to a party that I didn't want to go to because there were going to be people at it.
For more about our podcast, information on pitching a story, and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.
Baby, you want a moon pie? Okay. Go look down in the bottom of my purse. There's a banana moon pie with your name on it. But be careful, because my gun is in there, and I don't know if the safety's on.
Tune in next time for more stories from the Moth Radio Hour.
Just out of nowhere, one of the ladies said, oh, you know what? You have to come out. We do this rodeo every year in Pendleton, Oregon. You have to come. I said, okay, if you haven't noticed, I'm a brother from the hood. We don't do rodeos.
Join us next time for the Moth Radio Hour.